From the Jackalope Studios, high above the city in beautiful Zona Rosa, welcome to Minutes to Memories, reconnecting spirit, mind, and body, with your host, Dr. Daryl Drumright.
You need my love, baby, oh so bad. Don't you know you'll be in misery? They call me
Dr. Love.
They call me Dr. Love. I've got the cure you're thinking of.
Call me Dr. Love.
Live from the high atop Zona Rosa in North Kansas City, this is Dr. Drumright with Minutes of Memories on a Friday night happy hour. Go grab a cool one and sit down. We've got a couple important topics to talk about tonight. We're going to delve into my opinion on the vaccine controversy tonight, and then we're going to spend some time moving from the chi environment into the environment of cells and the living body. But first of all, I want to go through a couple paperwork things. I wanted to tell everybody that my website is harmonyhealth.com. It's been around for quite a while. It's a commercial website for my office or clinic that's just down the street from Zona Rosa. And then my Facebook is Daryl Drumright. And then there's Minutes to Memories on the Facebook as well, where we'll be posting links to the archive versions of the Jackalope radio program that we're recording right here. So that done, what I want to do is jump right into the vaccine issue. I have three children, an 11-year-old, 8-year-old, and one 7-year-old who just had a birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Mitchell. He got a Star Wars robotic arm for his birthday, Todd. He just digs it. He's moving this arm around. My children have never been vaccinated. They've never had a needle touch their skin or cross their skin in any way. They are some of the most healthy, alert, intelligent children you'll ever run across. A little too exuberant sometimes, lots of energy. Never had an injection or medication of any kind. So you wonder, how do I get them into school? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But first of all, we want to talk about vaccines in general and what I call the vaccine myth. You see, vaccines have been promoted in America for about 60 years now as the greatest invention of Western medicine. But come to find out, if you go back through the histories and actually look at the diseases that they claim to have gotten rid of, you'll find a very interesting, this is from the CDC records, this is from government records and from healthcare records, so this is nothing, it's something that you can look up yourself and become familiar with. But if you follow what they vaccinate for, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, they used to vaccinate for polio, whooping cough, even the smallpox from the late 19th century, early 20th century. If you observe the reduction of the diseases as time rolled through and then compare that to the time frame of the introduction of the vaccines, you come up with some very curious numbers. You see, as an example, whooping cough, if you follow the records down from the turn of the century, the 1880s, there was about 900 to 1,000 deaths per year. Come about 1935, the death rate was down to about 100 per year. But the vaccine wasn't even introduced until the 1940s and the 1950s. You move on to measles. Measles had several epidemics in the 20th century. Spiking around 1890s was the largest epidemic. Another epidemic in about 1915. But by 1940, measles was more than 90% eradicated, yet a vaccine didn't come out until the late 1960s. Typhoid fever is a very interesting example. By 1940, typhoid fever had dropped to over 600 deaths by 1910. By 1940, the deaths were down around 12, 15 deaths a year, yet there's no vaccination for typhoid fever. Disease went away about the same time frame as these vaccinated diseases before the vaccines came out, yet no vaccine in place. Diphtheria, same story. By 1930, the incidence rate had dropped by 90%. Vaccines weren't introduced till the 1940s, 1950s. Scarlet fever, no vaccine. By 1940, the disease had dropped from 180 death rates down to 20 death rates. Polio, the biggest one that you hear all the time, well, the iron lung and the crippled people, and I'm not belittling the sufferers of polio and spinal meningitis, but big scares in the 1950s of polio. By 1952-55, polio incidents had gone through three epidemics in the 20th century, and incidents were down to around five deaths per year. Yet the vaccine didn't come out until 1957, and then the disease continued to go away after that. So you see there's a pattern here that throughout the 20th century, something else was going on that was reducing the incidence and the dangers of infectious disease. So you look at another thing that was going on that I feel was probably one of the most important inventions of the 20th century, along with maybe electricity was probably important, and telephone was probably important, car, I like my car, so that definitely was important. But I feel like the most important thing probably happened to the human race during the 20th century was the reintroduction of indoor plumbing. You see, your plumber is one that got rid of infectious diseases and advanced the culture and survivability and took our survival rate into adulthood from deaths of 1 in 5 to deaths of 1 in 20. Indoor plumbing and increased hygiene and better food availability to the American people and the people around the world showed a significant and equal reduction of the incidence of these diseases. And then shortly after the successful introduction of indoor plumbing and people feeling better, the pharmaceutical industry promoted these vaccinations and simply took credit through a marketing campaign for an event that they had nothing to do with. So there's the history of the myth of vaccines. Now, what is in that vaccine? I'm sure you've all heard of these kind of things. Ever heard of thimerosal? Thimerosal is a mercury-based preservative that's used in the vaccine, especially what they call the multivalent vaccines. A multivalent vaccine is like DPT, one that has three different types of diseases all rolled into one shot. Now, why would they roll them all into one shot? Probably because parents are not going to let you inject their kid 27 different times. The compliance of getting these vaccines go way down if you're going to have to traumatize the child that many times. So to reduce the trauma, they create these multivalent or shove all the different diseases into one vial. Now, when you do that, these proteins and these very complicated processed chemicals tend to interact and react with each other and reduce the potency of the vaccine. So they use a preservative called thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative. Its job is to prevent the proteins from the different formats from interacting with each other and literally stabilize the concoction for shelf life. So mercury, and we remember last week we talked about fluoride, is probably one of the most toxic chemicals you can put in your body. Second to that, or probably even on equal status, is mercury. Everybody knows you don't break the thermometer and then touch the mercury, because mercury is a heavy metal that absorbs into your tissue and causes DNA damage and disruption. There is a lot of controversy now because childhood vaccinations, although they did not correspond with the reduction of the diseases that they reportedly cured, they do correspond directly with an increased incidence of childhood autism. Autism at the turn of the last century was virtually unheard of, yet now they say the statistics are somewhere around 1 in 3 or 1 in 5 children have Asperger's syndrome or some kind of form of ADD or potential autistic disorders. What's causing this neurological disruption? The experts and the officials refuse to look into this, and they just say it's a mystery that we need to figure out what's going on. But if you look at the hard facts, there is certainly implications and a growing body of evidence that the vaccine itself has a lot to do with the increase or incidence of autism. I can tell you the number of cases of parents that children were developing normally until 18-month booster shot and then suddenly receded into a dark mental closet and failed to thrive mentally from that point on. It's very saddening to see these kind of experiences when you see parents that are doing the best they can and being very good parents and trying to raise their children properly, yet following authorities' instructions, they wind up damaging their children, sometimes permanently, and then dealing with a mentally damaged child throughout its lifespan is incredibly traumatic emotionally and financially for these parents who were just trying to do the best they could. Very, very sad story, especially comparing it to the incorrect history that we've been taught. I wanted to bring up a science. And, you know, when we start pulling in callers on this radio show, I probably will bring this topic back up because I would like to discuss directly with somebody, anybody who thinks that they've got research that I haven't seen or some kind of published studies that may refute my opinions on this. I like to consider myself a scientist, which means my mind is open to new ideas at all times. I don't want to make an opinion and say I'm stuck into that. So if you can come up with evidence or something to the contrary of anything I say on this radio show, please bring it up and we'll discuss it. And I will be happy to eat my words if there is good evidence to the contrary. And then I will learn and grow and continue to make myself a better person. Science, by definition, is the ability to repeat something over and over, a process, and wind up with the same results. You've heard Einstein's theory of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting something different to happen. You see, as a scientist, Einstein knew that the way to prove something was to do it over and over. And if you wound up with the same results every time, then you could take your theory and basically lay it down that this is the way things work, because through observational repetition, we have determined that we can predict particular outcomes. So is there anything good about vaccines? I mean, is there anything positive about it? I know the military uses vaccines, and you use vaccines a lot when you go into high disease areas, traveling to Africa or other places. And animals, the veterinarians use vaccines, and they report some benefits to that. But I think that I would probably agree, if you're going into an area where the disease is very prevalent and high potency, and there's a lot of people running around with the disease, and you have a vaccine that can introduce a non-dangerous strain into your immune system for temporary protection from your travels, or if you have animal livestock that are all clustered in really poor hygiene areas and places where disease would like to grow, probably a vaccination of a less dangerous version of a disease could temporarily protect the livestock from developing high potency deadly diseases. In those kind of situations, I would, at this point, unless somebody, like I said, goes on with evidence otherwise, my opinion would probably fall to the side that there is some use for vaccines in high risk areas. But with a good hygiene of America, the way the American situation is now, where you have people brushing their teeth twice a day, please don't use fluoride on your toothpaste, but you're brushing your teeth, you're taking baths daily, you have indoor plumbing. 100 years ago, a once-a-month bath was probably a good thing. Nowadays, pretty much everybody takes a bath at least a couple times a week. Most people probably at least daily they take a shower or a bath because it's so convenient. When you turn the faucet on, all of a sudden there's your hot water. I can remember a day when I was a kid, even back in the 60s, going down to southern Missouri where they had a well, and your water was coming in from the well, and you had an outhouse out back. There was no indoor plumbing. So we've seen within the lifespan of people alive today a drastic change in lifestyle due to this incredible advancement of plumbing. My children attend a private school, but in the state of Missouri, and at least 48 of the 50 states that I know of have exemptions in the books. I know when you take your child to school, the school nurse is going to want to see their vaccine records, and they're going to tell you that it's the law that you have to have your children vaccinated to come to school. But I'm telling you very clearly that it's not the law that you have to have your children vaccinated. The law says you have to have your children either vaccinated or have an exemption form in the record saying that the parent either for religious purposes, medical purposes, and in some states, conscientious purposes, have an exemption on form, on file. Well, we're going to take our first break now. When we come back, we're going to change the subject.
We'll be right back. on trying and get better every day. But if I crossed a million rivers and I rode a million miles, then I'd still be where I started.
Jackalope 105 FM.
Hey, this is Dr. Drumright. Minutes of Memories on a Friday night here at jackaloperadio.com. So we've talked about vaccinations and how to get children into school without the vaccines. And I wanted to finish that topic off with the statement that, you know, I like informed choices. I'm never in my office judging people for what they decide to do, but I do ask you to please inform yourself and make the decision that best fits your needs and your lifestyle. And once those decisions made, then just stick with your decisions and love your children with all your heart and do everything you can to be a good parent for them. So we're going to change the topic. Last week we went to a nice thorough introduction of the theory of chi. Chi being life force, the thing that separates you from the chair you're sitting in right now. Today, right now, I want to move into a philosophical statement, and then we're going to advance from there. In my office, I have a saying that I use quite readily with people, especially people that are going through a lot loss of a loved one or any kind of trauma, change, is that the only thing that's really real in life is that things change. You see, nothing in life is permanent. Right now, your blood's pulsing and surging and cells are dying by the millions and new ones being born. In the last few seconds of my voice, and you're listening to this, the Earth has spun 100 miles around as it's spun it through space. So you see a planet spinning on its axis and flying through the debris of open space as it rotates around its star. And the stars rotating around the galaxy. Everything's moving and shifting and changing. Nothing ever stays the same. So within the body itself, that same dynamic is constantly at work. You look down at your body and it appears solid, but it's not. You hold your hand up in front of your face right now and imagine the billions of blood cells that have just moved in and out of your hand as each pulse of the heart beats. New cells come in and bring in fresh oxygen and attach to old carbon dioxide and start flushing that out. It's constantly seething and churning. In my office, when you come in with a new problem, it's pretty much clinically noted that when you start with a condition, it takes about 6 to 8 weeks for a bone to set or 6 to 8 weeks for any kind of trauma to resolve itself. So from that, I got an opportunity a couple months ago to go down to UMKC with my daughter and meet the Mentors Day. And I got to meet some PhD scientists from the DNA labs down, I think it's the Stowers Institute down there by UMKC. And I got to ask them a very interesting question. I looked them in the eye and said, can you give me your opinion on something? I said, what is the average lifespan of the human cell? He looked at me and he said, well, you know, there's brain cells that live a long time, and there's skin cells that only live a few hours, and there's liver cells and kidney cells and bone cells and blood cells. And I said, yeah, that's, I know all that, and it is an amazing thing that we call a body, but just give me your opinion. What is the average lifespan of the human cell? And he thought about it, and we talked for a while, and he took about 10 minutes to deliberate on this question. He kind of enjoyed thinking about that. And he come back and he said, in my expert opinion, and I am the expert, he had all kinds of letters in his name. I like smart people, you know, PhDs and BSs and all those fancy letters. He said, in my opinion, the average lifespan of the human cell is 6 weeks. I said, 6 weeks, huh? He goes, yep, that's my opinion, 6 weeks. Now, clinically, I was thinking more like 8 weeks because that's what I've seen over the last 18 years of working with people. But, hey, he's the expert, so I've been going with his opinion ever since then. 6 weeks. Average lifespan of the human cell is 6 weeks. So when you look down at your body, on average, that body is completely replaced every 6 weeks. So you're only 6 weeks old if you're counting the age of your body. So why does somebody who has been around this planet for 70 years look different than somebody who's been around the planet for 7 years? And the only logical answer to that is when the cells reproduce, they pass forward through the DNA memory of experiences so that the new cells are slightly modified to better suit the current environmental conditions. You see, the cells, as they use their DNA to reproduce into the next generation, are using different portions of the cells. The DNA scientists have kind of run into a dead-end wall recently in that they found that the genes of your cell do not, the protein synthesis or the creation of a reproduced cell is barely 3% of what they're doing. Most of what they're doing is literally vibrating in various sequences to orchestrate the life processes of the cell as it interacts with its environment. What does all that mean? Well, what it means is that the cells are constantly reproducing, and as they're reproducing, they're evaluating the environment. The environment means what foods they're getting, what activities they're engaged in, the thoughts of the owner person, the driver being, the stress load that it's under, how much rest time they're getting versus exercise. All these kind of things are variables that the cell is monitoring, and when it goes through its mitosis or its division, it's accessing or place, think of it as strumming the DNA strand in certain patterns to produce a new cell that's best adapted to the current environmental stresses. So from one 6 week period to another, you see a modification of the cell expression according to evolving and changing and ever changing stresses and pressures being put on the cell. A perfect example of this is, remember last November when it first started getting cold and the temperature dropped down in the low 40s and the upper 30s and how cold you felt? It felt really cold at that time. But then come late February, early March, and after that long cold winter we had here, that 40 degree temperature felt like tropical weather. You feel that every year, but see, there's a reason for that. In November, the cells that you're living in, the population of cells, remember they're only 6 weeks old, have all been born in the warmth of the summertime. So their adaptive capability is designed around a warmer climate. So when the climate changes and this current living cells are now experiencing a different climate, they send a reflex back to you, the owner of the avatar, saying, hey, you know, this is not fun. This is a lot colder than I'm used to. But then they begin the dividing process. And the new cells that are being born during this time frame are now genetically adapted to the colder weather. So you go through November and December and January and even early February. Now you're talking about, 16 weeks. So that's 6, 12, three different sets of cells as they've moved through the modification. So come early March, when the weather warms back up, now the cells you're living in, being only 6 weeks old, were all born in the cold weather. So they're genetically adapted to colder climates. So when the weather warms up, those cells are experiencing that warmer climate as a blessing of warmth as we move into the spring season. So you see, in 1 year's time, you have about 10 different bodies. Now, in acupuncture, a year's time is split into 12 segments, just like your day is split into 12 segments. So as you can see, the seasons move through, and we talk about chi patterns moving through the different seasons of the year. Your cell patterns are also modified as the environment changes around you, and your body continues to mutate and rearrange itself according to these seasonal stresses and changes. This is something that you can carry with you and think about on a regular basis. It's taught in basic anatomy in all medical schools, but yet most of your clinical practices are not designed around this knowledge. Clinical practices are much more designed around symptom treatment. You go to the doctor with a symptom, and the doctor's going to have a regime or treatment to work with that symptom and not so much work with the cell population as it's trying to compensate and deal with the current imbalances that are causing the symptoms. 6 weeks of cell population growth. Now, this information is challenging to the current medical paradigm because if your cells through their regeneration are constantly adapting to the current environment, when you put a chemical in, say an aspirin, on a consistent basis, it's not going to work very long because the cells are going to change their genetic expression to adapt to the new set of circumstances, which includes that chemical, and begin to adapt in their adaptation towards handling that. The effect of the symptom relief from the medication begins to subside because your cells are modified constantly. This also goes into a lot of the what they like to call permanent disease processes. Understanding that the cells are in a constant state of regeneration, there's really nothing permanent about the body, especially imbalances and diseases. You see, nothing in the universe is permanent. That's the basic premise here. I can prove to you right now that the building you're standing in or sitting in right now is not solid and not permanent. Simply in your imagination, go forward in time 10,000 years. 10,000 years from now, is that building there? Of course not. 10,000 years of the planet spinning and the earthquakes and the storms and everything and the abuse that the planet has, the planet, like a cell, is constantly changing and evolving. The building is no longer there. It's just changing at a slower pace than you are. So in your consciousness, you project an image of being solid because it's moving slower than you do. Everything changes just at a different pace. Your perspective on this change is what determines your reality. All right. Thank you very much, Todd. This is Minutes to Memories on a Friday night. Everybody go get another cold one. Then we're going to move into a changing mindset and look at the interface between the body and the soul.
Sometimes I feel like I am drunk behind the wheel of possibility, however it may roll. Give it a spin, see if you can somehow factor in. You know there's always more than one way to say exactly what you mean to say. Was I out of my head or was I out of my mind? How could I have ever been so blind? I was waiting for an indication, it was hard to find. Don't matter what I say, only what I do. I never mean to do bad things to you. So quiet, but I finally woke up. If you're sad, then it's time you spoke up too. Was I out of my head or was I out of my head?
So we've been talking about the ever-changing body and the cell population. Now we're going to move into a kind of a different variation of what happens and when the cells of the body have a problem and how they can interact and work with that. One of the very first lessons I talk to patients when they come into the office, because normally in America, you don't go to the doctor until you have a problem. So the problem usually that brings people into my office is pain. Pain, this elusive word. I ask people the question right off the bat, define pain for me. Please give me a definition. What is this thing called pain? And you know, 90% of the time, they give me this really funny look, and they just kind of smile at me. It's like, what are you saying, doc? It's like, well, it hurts. It hurts. That's what it hurts. I'm like, yeah, but what is it? I mean, what is this thing? They're like, well, it makes me uncomfortable. And you know, comfort's an important part of clinical practice, because Americans are taught that life is supposed to be comfortable. So my job is, they're hiring me to do, is help make them comfortable again. So coming off of that, I want to approach it from an educational standpoint. We start discussing pain again. So I say, you know, define it. What is pain? They say, well, it's sharp, or it keeps me from working. I'm like, yes, it does do that. It interferes with your comfort and maybe keeps you from working, or it makes you do things in a funny way because it hurts to do it correctly. But that doesn't really tell me what it is. That's like me asking you, what is a chair? And you say it's brown with four legs. Well, that tells me what it looks like, but it doesn't tell me what is a chair. And a chair is a four-legged structure that you sit in that provides support for you. So I go easy on them, you know, and I tell them, look, let me tell you what, I'll just give you the definition of pain, and I'm sure this is going to make sense to you, because it's common sense, and we'll go from there. In Grey's Anatomy, not the TV show, the book Grey's Anatomy, they define pain as an electrical signal or communication from the cells of the body to the cells of the brain. The cerebral cortex is where perception and your understanding of reality occurs. So when the body has something going on within its population of cells, it has to communicate with you, the driver being, somehow. And the most obvious and quick communication is a shout out to you saying, hey, there's something going on right here. And this is what we call pain. It's a acetylcholine electrical chemical stimulation along the neurons and the alpha nerves in the body that come into the cerebral cortex. All those big words, fancy words, simply mean message. When the body has an imbalance, it has to recruit you, the driver being, to help it recover and regain its balance. So it sends this message to you saying, hey, I need your attention. Now, sadly, in our current cultural teachings and the way things work, we're taught that when the body sends this message to us, we're supposed to sit down, avoid the activity that made it happen, compensate for it, or take a pill for it to numb it out. Now, think of pain as a smoke detector signal coming to you, the owner of the house, telling you that there's a fire in the house. Now, if you get up and go unplug the smoke detector, you know that it's not buzzing in your ear anymore, so you're more comfortable without the smoke detector going off. But what about the fire? Did that do anything at all to put out the fire? Of course not. Treating the smoke detector does nothing to put out the fire in your house. Same thing with pain in your body. Pain is just the message, just the smoke detector. It's never the problem. And I realize that it can be very loud, very overwhelming, and can make you sit down and not get up. It's so focused into your consciousness. That's simply the body's way of making itself a priority to you. And most people are so busy in their daily lives that they give their body very little thought. The body's there. It does what you tell it to do. It's a wonderful slave to your thoughts. It's very productive. You go on and on throughout your days and nights and just basically ignore it. You feed it the standard American diet, the sad diet of potato chips and cookies and pop. And it still wants to serve you. It does its best it can until something really bad happens and you can't go out there and work and slave away. Then it becomes a priority and you do something about it. hopefully, after you talk to a chiropractor and come to my office a couple times, we start talking about taking care of the cell population and taking advantage of its regenerative powers and start making modifications to what you do with it and depend on that six-week growth cycle to get it going in the right direction. So pain, as loud and as annoying, as uncomfortable as is, it's just a message. And so I have people start practicing calling it message. So when they come into the office after the first couple of visits, I'll say, what's your body telling you? What is the message? And I love it when they get it. And after a while, they come in and they don't even use the word pain anymore. They say, my body's telling me that I need some attention right here. And they'll point to it and I'll say, hey, hit the deck and we'll work on that. So the pain is a communication message to the consciousness trying to coordinate between you, the driver being, the spirit, and the body. That makes the brain or the mind as a communication device between the two. Now, remember we talked about how the cells of the body are constantly evolving and changing to the stress patterns? Well, come to find out, the matrix of dendrite connections, which is the extensions of your brain cells, your nerve cells, is even more dynamic and regenerates and grows around even faster than the cells do. Your brain can literally rewire itself in an instant. We define consciousness as it rides on a three-legged stool. Within your brain, you have a capacity to remember past experiences. And these are matrices of wiring that are laid down from prior experiences that are there for your retrieval later on for use for improved survivability. You have survived this experience doing this certain thing, so you can use that again in the future, so you lay down these memories. You also have current incoming stimulation coming from the body at the moment, and then these are what we could, like the pain receptor sites and these kind of things, and your eyes are sending you signals from what you're seeing in the visible light spectrum, and your ears are sending you signals from what they're hearing within the audible sound spectrum. All these things are constantly being coming into the brain on a moment-by-moment basis. And then the third part of your conscious reality is your imagination. It's literally images that are created out of thin air from your thoughts and then organized into patterns within the cerebral cortex. As you move moment to moment on the sea of time and move forward through your life, your perceptual consciousness bounces around between these three areas of past, present, and future. The amount of time you spend in each one of these areas is going to determine what direction you move forward into your particular future. You see a lot of people hung up on past experiences. They just relive the same past over and over again, and they don't seem to move forward because in their mind, they're reliving these old experiences. And you see other people that try to be in the moment because they're and these are very happy people usually because they're existing and smelling the flowers and just watching very Tao. They're watching the universe move around them and interacting with it on a moment-to-moment basis. And then you have other people that are living in the future most of the time because they're planning and preparing and putting things in order for what their imagination thinks of as either a positive future because they're preparing for it or a very scary future because their imagination is coming up with threats. And so they have to prepare their environment to protect survivability against the threats. Now, there was an article I reviewed and wrote my own version of back in 2007 called The Seven Tenets of the Human Brain. We're going to very briefly, and I apologize, it feels like I'm reading because I actually am going to read some of the highlights of this, of how the brain works. So modern science now has a clear picture of what happens in your brain as you deal with life. The physical brain is much more pliable than we ever imagined. This article explains how and why some of us are successful, why others of us are sick. Please be one of the first to enjoy this amazing article. This will be a centerpiece for my professional seminars next year. First tenet, change can occur only when the brain is in the mood. The brain is in a constant flux. It's always changing, always either rearranging or reinforcing its pathways and patterns. Your point of attention is the key to what dissectable physical formation the brain will soon be in. What that means is Everything I'm talking about here is not philosophy. You can take the brain apart and its wirings and see little physical changes in the structures of the brain according to the things that you've learned and the things that you're thinking about. Chemical on and off switches that allow learning to occur are turned on by your attention to novelty and turned off by repeatedly using learned non-challenging behavior. This is very important because to keep the brain flexible, and there's an old Chinese saying, is you're only as old as you are stiff. This works both in the body through exercise and the brain in the novel expression and experience. Crossword puzzles have been said to help prevent Alzheimer's and the degeneration of the brain, but they're not very effective because it's a habitual over and over use. So you're literally creating hard patterns in the neural matrix of the brain. What you need to do to keep the brain flexible is to approach a new hobby or come up with a new activity or something that you've never done before. And in so doing, your brain will immerse itself in chemicals to soften the neurons and allow the dendrites to change their organization and stay flexible in their expression. Number two, change strengthens connections between neurons engaged at the same time. Learning is accomplished by testing combinations of connections, then comparing observed outcomes versus what the brain wants and doesn't want. Changing hardwired connections selectively as a behavior approximates the desired outcome previously formulated by the brain. Okay, what does that mean? What that means, a very good example is learning a new habit like playing tennis. You take your motor neurons or the neurons of the brain that tell the body what to do, and you say, I want to hit that ball right over there, and you swing the racket and whack the ball. Well, it doesn't quite go where it wants, kind of in the same direction, but not exactly. So your brain kind of evaluates that and then makes some changes and rewires itself according to all those different neurons that were used to move the shoulder, to move the knee, to move the different parts of the body. And it'll wire them all together into one little package so that next time you want to do that, you don't have to think of all those different things. They all kind of run together into one connected pattern. Number three, neurons that fire together wire together. Your sensory input is rich and complex. That means the stuff coming in, your eyesight and your ears, it's all kinds of stuff coming in. They say that you process consciously about 20 to 30,000 units of information at a time, which is amazing compared to computers. But ultimately, the brain is bringing in over 3 billion signals from the trillions of cells of the body and telling different balance points and the different things that are happening. So you're access to the information coming in is limited by the lower brainstem, so you're only getting a small portion of what's happening from this rich environment. The brain strengthens its connections between that things that reliably occur in serial time. What that means is if the same thing is happening repeatedly, when you do this, this happens. When you pick up a pen and strike it across the paper, it leaves a mark. And it does that over and over again, then the wiring of the eyesight and the wiring of the hands, they all kind of create this pattern inside your brain to organize a learning process. The point of attention, where you're putting your time, what you're thinking about, where learning occurs, is not compartmentalized. Past memories, present sensory stimulation, and imagination all constantly blend as your brain weaves its own explanation of reality, and from that develops memories, skills, and dreams. Four, initial changes are temporary. If the brain judges the experience to be interesting, exciting, or somehow novel, and relates to either a desirable or undesirable outcome, it will release a chemical that makes these connections permanent. So, when you have an experience, like you're driving down the car and the car beside you is blue, and you know, but you don't remember that because these are just non-long-term useful experiences. So the brain just kind of brings them in, lets them go back out. It lets the sea of change occur around it. But when something happens that really strikes your curiosity or really kind of strikes a chord with you, then your brain's going to release chemicals into the matrix of neurons and cause this particular experience to stay there. I remember in high school, one of the teachers taught us that, I mean, he would drop a book or suddenly startle the kids right after he said something that he wanted them to remember. Because we know with adrenaline and different hormones that are released into the bloodstream, it causes the brain to lock down whatever experiences it had been processing in the most recent past. So if you were daydreaming and imagining something else and the teacher did that, you're not going to remember what he was talking about, but you are going to remember whatever that daydream was that you were processing the few minutes prior to the sudden start. Number five, brain plasticity is a two-way street. Now, this is a very, very important one. The point of attention drives physical brain changes just as easily positively as it does negatively. Many identified mental disorders can be explained with a plastic brain. Chronic pain syndromes occur when the electrical signal from a pain sensory cell is overstimulated for a long time. Like riding a bike, the brain gets really good at using these connections, so that any associated stimulation, a smell, someone you don't like, will fire the whole wire and further attract the point of attention into a vicious cycle. Unwanted bad habits continue to pester us because through years of repeated behavior, the brain has hardwired itself into this set of connections. Then by repeating timeline, association of this behavior, sets of connections with other experiences, it becomes entrenched into our entire understanding of self. Obsessive compulsive disorders are treated by teaching the person that those obsessive fears are not real. They are just old wires repeating an incorrect image. I use this particular part of the brain very effectively in the office for things like smoking cessation. When we use acupuncture to assist with that, we use this for alcohol, we use this for weight control, we use this particular technique on a number of different things to help you guide your future thoughts, which will determine your future cell population, and then therefore the reaction between your spirit or the choices you make, the mind or the communication device between the body and the spirit and the actual body population of cells. We've got a couple more portions of this, and this kind of gets into the more complex issue, Todd. So as you're showing me that we're running towards the end of this, I want to like cut this off, and we'll pick this back up next week. I do want a couple notes. The way I'm doing this radio show, I'm very happy that we're saving these files because, as you can tell, I'm covering some pretty deep topics here that the first time through, I'm sure it's going to be a little bit over your head or not, but to some people, it's going to be very useful to take these recordings and listen to them repeatedly so that when we start having callers, we'll probably go back through some of this topic and this material and answer specific questions and work through this with some very specific case studies and things like that. This information is very crucial to the way I run the clinic. We have regenerative lifestyle. Go to my website, harmonyhealth.com, and there's a video of me there doing the myth of aging. We're going to talk about that next week, about how the body will determine how old you are by your activity levels and what's going on within the body. So there is no such thing as a permanent disease. That's one we want to get out of this week, that everything is changing, nothing is solid, that the body you're living in now is designed specifically for the experiences and the environment that you've been exposed to over the last 6 weeks to 6 years, that by simply changing, and I'll give you some techniques on how to do this, having fun with this, in changing your behavior and changing your activities and your thoughts, you can see your body very quickly remold and remodify itself into a much more happy, more youthful, younger version of you. So, happy hour Friday night. Thank you very much, Todd, for the opportunity to spend this time on air with listeners at jackaloperadio.com. We will be archived very shortly, and I want to release the mic back to my good friend Todd.
Thank you, Dr. D. Without you, we wouldn't be doing this show. So it's an honor. It's a pleasure. And everybody, we'll be here next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
And a man who thinks he's out. talking to, and the hobbit on the rocks is crying, and the fish upon the docks are dying, yeah. And the hobbit on the rocks is crying. There's an orchestra in Rococo and an insulated dwarf, and the ships are sinking in the sea as they sail.